Hey folks, Carolyn here to tell you just a little bit about the Games and Online Harassment Hotline. It's a free, text message-based, confidential emotional support hotline that was created specifically for the gaming community. So whether you're a player, a developer, a streamer, a competitor, any part of the gaming community, the hotline is here for you, ready to provide emotional support or help finding the referrals and resources that you may need. Visit gameshotline.org for more information.
Man, I'm gonna have to watch this movie again a couple of times, and I have to tell you, I'm a little bit resentful over it. You know, I'm gonna wait till it's free, so it's probably gonna be, you know, a year.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Carolyn Pettit, and I'm joined by the woman who is recording this podcast with me as a temporal pincer movement, Ebony Adams. Hey, Ebony.
Got my red armband, got my blue armband. I'm ready.
Fantastic. So Anita's away this week. She's probably in a shipping container somewhere moving backwards through time to recruit me to Feminist Frequency several years in the past. If these references make any sense to you, you've probably seen Tenet. If they don't, good luck understanding this episode of FFR, because Ebony and I are going to be discussing Christopher Nolan's latest high-concept blockbuster. So stay tuned. Well, hey, Ebony, how are you?
Okay, so the day that we're recording this is Monday, January 18th. It is a day that we set aside to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So on the one hand, I'm trying to immerse myself in his writings and speeches. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happens on this day, as opposed to all other days when people are just so nuanced and, you know, incisive with their commentary about Dr. King, but no, particularly on MLK Day, you have the most like bootleg, trite, cliche, you know, kind of like hand wavy, hey, can't we all just get along? Isn't that what Dr. King wanted? Kind of statements coming out of people. And it's always hilarious, in quotation marks, to see the Twitter roundup of these things from like the CIA or ICE or like various sheriff's departments when they're like, you know, today we celebrate the life and work of Dr. King. And you're like, are you? Are you though? Really? So to combat that, in addition to trying to think through ways that I can be of service to people, because one of the ways that people celebrate Dr. King is by marking his birthday as a day of service, which is hard to do during quarantine.
Sure.
You know, in the ways that I traditionally have done it, by like leaving the house. But so I'm like, you know, I'm trying to like get into his speeches and actually remind myself of like his like defiantly anti-capitalist stance, you know, his like really radical positions. Cause, you know, he's been flattened into this milquetoast, kind of like civil rights teddy bear, because it's very useful for our white supremacist power structure, right? To actually, you know, wave away what the man said and what he did and what he stood for. You know, he's like, you know, oh, he's the appropriate version of you know, black liberation, as opposed to people like Malcolm X or whatever. So anyways, that's a long, useless intro to how am I doing today. That is how I'm doing. No, I'm trying to resist, you know, participating in that kind of like, you know, third grade social studies understanding of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, obviously my Twitter feed is very cultivated by me to, you know, be largely voices of people who don't make my blood boil and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's very, I recognize that it's a very, you know, non-representative of what the larger conversation happening is actually like. But it is encouraging to me that it seems to me that there is more of a reckoning now and more of like a, with like Dr. King's radical, you know, political ethic, with his, you know, his anti-capitalist stance, his the way that he spoke of racial justice and economic justice as, you know, inseparable, you know, from each other, these kinds of things. Because I don't know, it seems to me that it is harder for those white moderates that who he so vehemently and I mean just sort of chastised and you know who he described in such precise language in his own work that it's harder for them to get away with today. I think the kind of that softening and like the airbrushing of you know who Dr. King was and what he stood for. At least I hope that that's true. You know that there are more, you know, more voices being like, no, we're not going to let you get away with that anymore. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So I mean, it's yeah, and I mean, this is a week. This is like the inauguration is what 2 days away. Woo! As we're recording this. So you know, it's a momentous, you know, week. I think anyway we cut it. Not that we think Biden necessarily is going to be a herald of ushering in tremendous progressive change or what have you, but certainly it is significant given where we're coming from and what we've been through the past 4 years.
Right.
So, all right. Well, yeah.
Speaking of world changing events, y'all, since Anita's not here, you can count on me to fill her chair when it comes to labored segues, you know, broken metaphors. I will probably mispronounce a couple of things just to keep it real. You know, you will not miss Anita because I'm going to be cosplaying as her verbally.
I mean, certainly Christopher Nolan, who was so reluctant to let Tenet go the way of the online, you know, on demand, you know, release. He really was committed for a long time and held on for so long to Tenet being a theatrical release. And I mean, understandably so, because it is, I think, a very cinematic film in the sense of just doing things visually that are unique to what cinema can as a medium can accomplish, right? Let's get into that. All right, so in the realm of, here's my labored more labored intro to the Tenet discussion.
Hit it.
In the realm of video games, people sometimes say that auteur Hideo Kojima is a game maker who secretly wants to be a film director. I don't entirely agree with that assessment, but I do sometimes think that by the same token, we can perhaps think of Christopher Nolan as a filmmaker who half wishes he were a game designer. In films like Inception and his latest, Tenet, he invents, like I always hear Tenet in the voice of our latest movie trailer guy. I just, for whatever reason, just the way that he says that title was just in the most dispassionate way. It has come to define how I hear that title in my head. But anyway, in films like Inception and Tenet, Nolan evinces a fascination with rules and systems, with rigid mechanisms of plot that bind the characters and define the way in which their struggles play out. Even the way in which John David Washington's heroic CIA agent, who finds himself fighting a Cold War against the future, is referred to as the protagonist, strikes me as a pretty video gamey touch. And Tenet, as a whole, strikes me as a film that's almost designed to provoke discussion and debate about the logic of its plot, about the spectacle of its action sequences, and about whether or not it all adds up to a good film. So let's get into it. I guess maybe one thing I want to start with, like, before we, you know, maybe get lost in the weeds of just how, like, intricate the plot is and all the questions that it raises, like, one thing that I think is just fun and exciting to me about this film is how, you know, if you sort of map it onto, like, a James Bond film, which I think it invites those comparisons because in Seder, its villain, played by, you know, menacingly by Kenneth Branagh, you have a billionaire villain who literally wants to, like, bring about the end of the world. You know, this larger than life, the stakes are so massive. You know, then you have, I mean, John David Washington is kind of mapped onto the Bond figure in a sense. And, you know, there's always been debates of like, or conversations about, well, if James Bond literally, you know, if Idris Elba played Bond or what have you, right? Could it even work? And because part of what allows James Bond to move in that world so invisibly and seamlessly is like his whiteness, right? Let's be honest. But, and so right. I think to me, what's interesting is the way that, like the protagonist of this film, the protagonist, you know, I mean, as played by John David Washington, like, I guess there have been conversations about whether he's deracinated in the film in this role. And so my view about that is definitely is that he's not. I mean, I think the that he moves in the world in a way that like he, you know, he knows he's black. Of course, he knows that that makes him different, makes him other. But he kind of plays it up in fun ways at times. At least it seems to me like the way that he, when he goes to have lunch with Michael Caine's character, and they, you know, the he's like, I'm Michael Crosby's lunch, and the guy's like, I presume you mean Sir Michael Crosby. And rather, you know, and he's just like, well, presume away. Like, he's kind of like, right. You know, he kind of is like, he's like, I'm not going to go along with your bullshit kind of customs. And similarly in a restaurant, you know, later in the film, when he goes into the kitchen or whatever, and he says,
says I asked for my hot sauce.
He says, like, I ordered my hot sauce an hour ago. I mean, like a white, you know, James Bond would not say that particular line, right. At least, right? So I don't know. I thought, I mean, to me, this film leverages John David Washington's charisma in ways that are super exciting. Like he's very, it's very like internalized, I think, his performance, but which makes those little moments where he has fun or he kind of is more expressive, feel that much bigger and more, I don't know, exciting. And the charisma just kind of explodes off of him, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. So I've read, several things about the film since I saw it, excuse me, but none of the pieces that I read specifically mentioned this deracination. So that's interesting. I want to maybe try and search that out because it would never have occurred to me to think that precisely for the reasons that you bring up, you know, like the various like, you know, kind of cultural flourishes that he embraces, you know? I mean, there's a quality to his tone and the way that he speaks that absolutely, you know, like positions him as a young black man, like clearly and audibly to me. So, and you know, yeah, you know, the mention of hot sauce or the way that he, you know, sort of revels in making people sort of acknowledge why he makes them uncomfortable in certain situations, whether that be because of race or whether that be because of class. So, you know, you talk about that lunch he has with Michael Caine. And, you know, Michael Caine points out, like, if you're going to meet with this billionaire, you need better clothes.
Yeah.
And he looks at it and he's like, you know, I mean, it's a very funny moment. I would love to, you know, to think more about that.
Sure.
When I was watching this film, and I watched it with my partner. He noted, like, oh, you know, this absolutely is, you know, kind of an entry into that ever appealing spy genre, like the Mission Impossible movies, like the James Bond movies. And John David Washington is a very able lead actor for this. Like, he's so physical in an exciting way, but it's a very assured way, like it's very controlled.
Yes.
And I absolutely loved that. But so this is me working my way eventually to my point, which is that it is very interesting to me that when we do allow black men, and I should perhaps expand this to any non-white actor to carry a lead role in this particular genre, the way that they do get I don't know if desexualized is the right word, but I have little doubt that there would have been room for a love scene or a romance, either with the Elizabeth Debicki character or with someone else in this film, if it were Tom Cruise or, you know, if roles were reversed and Robert Pattinson was playing the lead. I just think that would have been a sort of natural element to it.
Yeah.
But I think there is something so dangerous about the figure of a Black man who is, you know, like physically dominant and also intellectually, you know, very savvy and astute, also being very like sexually, visibly sexual desirable on screen, you know? I there were moments, you know, as we got to know the, after the Elizabeth Debicki character was introduced, I was like, oh, are they setting something up here? You know, how exactly is that going to work? And then they didn't. And I was like, I do wonder, you know, what the notes were like, if at any point, and I'm sure they were, you know, the studio notes were like, can we get, you know, some love scenes in there? You know, can we fit in a sexy, you know, woman, half naked woman in there and linger on her ass as we, you know, the camera travels up her body. Nolan, could we work that in somehow? And then the choice was made not to do that. It's very interesting for me who's allowed that sort of, you know, behavior on screen and who isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think.
And I'm not saying the film needed it, by the way.
No.
That's what I'm, yeah.
Right. I find, you know, Nolan has this, there's something about Nolan's sensibility as an action filmmaker, I think, where there's almost, I don't know, I don't want to, I feel like putting it in, saying documentary-like is too strong a word, but I feel like there's something less stylistically flourishing about his approach to this kind of filmmaking than like he wants it to feel very grounded and says like the feeling that I get often from watching a Nolan film from like say this and again Inception in particular. There's a particular pleasure I get from these films, which is not what I get from, it's kind of almost unique to Nolan, and something about the way his camera presents environments and people within those environments is that I get a pleasure that's a lot like the pleasure I get paging through a high-end fashion magazine.
Yeah.
Because it's always like, beautiful people in beautiful clothing, you know, in beautiful places. And, you know, so you have almost these spreads, almost like these shots that were just like, oh, that could be a fashion ad or something.
Right.
And, you know, and all the places, it's like, you're not seeing places where there's like, you know, McDonald's on the corner or like a Target or whatever, any kind of chain. It's all like, you know, these places that, I mean, they're kind of defined, I guess, then by wealth and by privilege. But there is, for me, also that, like, wonderful kind of escape to places that vicariously, to places that feel less defined by like, the everyday commerce of that's inescapable in the world in which you live, and, like, billboards and advertisements and corporate logos and these things just everywhere, right? There's something almost refreshing for me about thus, like, entering into the world of a Nolan film.
Right.
Yeah. Though, for me, the flip side of that is that, like, the film's always... Well, again, and I'm talking particularly about Inception and this film here because those are the two I think of as like his like logic puzzle films, his like mechanical, you know, sort of intricate like clockwork mechanism films. Is that there's always the films always feel a bit at a remove to me, like they're way more concerned with those kinds of rules and systems and the machinery of their plots than they are with like. With, you know, actual human behavior and insight into the human condition or what have you. Like, you know, to me, Inception was a film about dreams that doesn't understand or acknowledge how dreams actually work. Like, it you know, it's like, that's not how, you know, dreams are not these, like, precise, you know, there's no dream logic in a film about dreams. And similarly here, I almost wanted at some point the rules to, like, break down and for some kind of, you know, new possibility that the characters didn't anticipate or didn't see coming to burst into the situations of the narrative, but it doesn't happen. Like, it all still feels like this hermetically sealed thing where it's all like everything can be, you know, I don't know that I fully understand it, but I trust that, like, oh, you know, it all can be logicked away, right? It can all be, mm-hmm. like, explained away. And that, like, ultimately, like, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's part of why maybe I prefer a David Lynch, you know, to a Christopher Nolan, ultimately, is, like, I feel like I feel like there's something more true or real in terms of reflecting how we actually live our lives and what it is to be human in the dream logic of a Lynch film than there is in the kind of rigid puzzle logic of a Nolan film, speaking in very broad terms.
Yeah, I just speaking about, like, you know, David Lynch and Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
When I watch, when I rewatch David Lynch films, I'm very conscious of being invited in to that film and into the world of that film. And so when I rewatch, I am rewatching for enjoyment. With Christopher Nolan films, you know, there's a pervasive joke that, you know, you're going to have to watch it a couple of times to really get things, right? And there's a part of me that pushes back against that. I'm fine rewatching things over and over again. I do it all of the time. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we should, you know, unpack what it means for a filmmaker to build that into, you know, the expectation of a film. Because I really do think that, you know, there is work that is being demanded of a viewer. And I don't shy away from, you know, having work thrust upon me. But I do think that after having watched Tenet, and I was only able to watch it once before we recorded this podcast, you know, having only watched it once, there's a sense I have that something is undone, that I'm not quite there yet.
Mm.
You know, that there are interlocking pieces that I will pick up on, and that, you know, things perhaps might fit better together for me. And so, you know, it's as if I've gone through, you know, round one, but I need to complete my training, you know, on this level or something. And so, you know, it's distancing for me. At the same time that I really enjoyed, there are some amazing set pieces.
Yes.
In this film. And so I am disappointed that I did not get to see this on the big screen, because I do think the experience of, I mean, not just, like, you know, the climactic, you know, sort of fight on the battlefield, that Russian, you know, around the Russian battlefield where they're trying to get the MacGuffin. But you know, when the protagonist and Neil are, like, base jumping off this building, you know, in Mumbai.
Oh, yeah.
There are moments that are so crisp and so beautifully composed and shot that they just demanded, you know, the big screen and surround sound. And so, yeah, no matter, you know, how excited I am about my 62-inch screen at home and think I'm balling, it's never going to, you know, replicate being in a theater and watching that.
Yeah, and I mean, that is one thing that I do appreciate about this film is the, as I said earlier, the kind of the uniquely cinematic, like, what Nolan's plot concept of, okay, you know, reversing the entropy of objects or people such that they're moving backwards in time relative to what we think of as the forward flow of time, how that allows for genuinely unique spectacles, you know, of I mean, even, for instance, the fight where the protagonist is fighting with a figure who we later learn to be himself coming, you know, backwards through time. You know, it doesn't look like quite like any fight scene that we've seen before. And there's a, mm-hmm. there's maybe even like a goofiness to it in the sense of like there's an awkwardness to it, perhaps I should say, in that the movements of one,
right.
you know, figure are always kind of, you know, clearly moving backwards or just out of joint with what the other is doing. But that's what makes it so unusual, right? That's what makes it a Tenet fight as opposed to just a fist fight slash grapple fest that we might see in any other film. I love the things like the base jumping and the, you know, all of these like set piece moments, but I do love that this is a film. I mean, part of what I'd love to say about the Mission Impossible films is that globe hopping sense of adventure, right? This sense of like the interlocking world of intrigue. And I think one thing I really appreciate in this film is that one of the key players in all of these shenanigans, which I don't pretend ultimately, I watched the film twice and I still don't fully grasp her role in it, but is Priya, this arms dealer who clearly, you know, is very important in all the workings of the film, is an Indian woman, you know, played by and I Dimple Kapadia, and I may be mispronouncing her name, but who plays her is, I believe, a well-known actor in Indian cinema, who I don't think I've seen before, but you know, her presence, her prominent, you know, role in the narrative here, I think it really helps make this film feel grander in scope than it would if it were just like, oh, there's Kenneth Branagh and, you know, Robert Pattinson and what have you.
Yeah, I mean, the film does, you know, live up to sort of its grand aspirations. Kenneth Branagh is just biting into a huge ham sandwich in this role. He relishes, you know, he does this so well, like just skating the edge of campiness almost with the way that he exudes this, like, you know, kind of oily, malice. He is a very bad man.
I mean, he literally, like, he could not be more, like megalomaniacal Bond villain in the sense where he literally says at one point of his wife, you know, if I can't have you, nobody can. And that ideology extends to the world itself, right? Like, he literally wants to bring about effectively the end of the world. He wants to reverse the flow of time at the moment of his own death, because if he can't live, you know, then why should any of us, you know, in who share this era with him be able to live either?
Okay. Like I said, I only watched the movie once. And if you have not seen the movie, obviously it's hard to say, you know, we spoil things because it's not going to make any sense without you, like, actually, you know, press and play on that bad boy and digging in. Like, this, we could be speaking Greek, you know, for all you know right now. But so essentially, John David Washington, CIA agent, you know, at the beginning of the film, is involved in some covert op at a Russian opera house. Ultimately, he is captured by the bad guys, bites down on a suicide pill. Turns out the suicide pill was a fake, is recruited into this, you know, shadowy organization called Tenet, which has been put together to fight the forces. I mean, when you say it out loud, oh boy, the forces of the future who are waging war on the past. And the reason they are doing this is because we fucked up the Earth.
Yeah.
Via climate change. And this was real interesting to me. You know, like, it's... God. Okay, this is the point where I lose it, Carol, because I can trace where I sort of threw up my hand. No, let me not say that, because I didn't give up, you know, on trying to make sense of things in the film. But there was a point where I was like, okay, you know, I'm just going to go with this, you know, like, whatever happens. And it was right around the time when during the course of the car chase.
Yeah.
Like, we get the car chase the front ways, and then we're in that, like, bunker area.
Yeah.
And there's the inverse Kenneth Branagh. Who's going to shoot
The interrogation that we see both forwards and then effectively backwards.
Right. And at that point, I was just like, well, I'm just going to try and follow what's going along here and just, you know, watch things. But the whole notion of like the future waging war on the past, it was funny to me. But also I found it so interesting that it was this moment at which the future chose to focus their particular energy. Like, that's how the narrative works. Like, what is going on in, you know, the year of our Lord 2020, 2021, you know, they were like, that's when, you know, things are going to stop. So it was built towards, you know, Kenneth Branagh, as you say, like deciding, well, once I'm going to die, there's no reason for anyone else to live here. And I just found it very interesting. And also that, you know, it was climate change, because it felt like such an old kind of throwback, like 1980s style Bond villain, like, you know, I'm going to deplete the Earth's oil resources, or, you know, I'm going to melt the polar ice caps. Like, it made sense, but also I was like, huh, so this is the thing that, you know, that sends us back? Okay.
I mean, I'm a little... I am hung up on the film's invocation of climate change, because I feel like, for me, it feels kind of defeatist, in the sense that that it seems to me that the film only works, like, the logic of the film only works if we accept that, as Neil, I think, puts it a few times, that what's happened happened. So, which means then, like, if that's the case, then that climate change, like, that we don't, you know, like, that we don't stop the course of climate change, and it does result in disaster and all of that. But also, like, I guess it's, okay, so Tenet is, why isn't Tenet as an organization then? Why isn't, like, what would be kind of almost to me super exciting or interesting to see is, what if an organization like Tenet, with the ability, the knowledge of how to, like, go backwards in time, you know, such through the reversing of entropy of people and objects and what have you, like, why aren't they engaged in trying to undo or fight, like, the climate crisis? Like, wouldn't that be? Shouldn't that be something that they pour a lot of their energy into? But we don't see any, we don't get any indication of that. It seems that their only goal or their only focus is on fighting the war with the future, such as it is. And there's also, to me, something a little irksome about then the idea of the protagonist, who is sort of positioned, I would say, by the film's conclusion, by its final scene and what he says, some of the things he says about himself, as, like, the one who can save the world, like the figure, the individual who and obviously with the help of, you know, other people like Neil and with Tenet as an organization, but that he is, like, so crucial and so central to all of this. And I feel like, you know, I mean, I guess I just, I mean, I'm sort of tired of, you know, stories in general that place saving the world, you know, on the shoulders of, like, one person, one kind of chosen one, you know, whether it's Neo or the protagonist or what have you. But I mean, but climate change in particular is, I feel, something that should be framed as an issue of collective action, right? Collective action. And so, I don't know, there are definitely things about the film's, its invocation of climate change as just, it almost doesn't even seem interested in climate change as an actual threat to human life. It's purely a plot, you know, point, a motivator for the people in the future who wish to do us harm. And I don't know, to me that just feels a little dismissive when in reality, climate change is such an urgent and real threat. And when we do have the power right now to do something about it, but it does absolutely require, like, global, you know, action, like collective action on a global scale to start to ensure that we have a planet to pass on to, you know, that's livable for future generations.
Yeah, Yeah. Man, I'm gonna have to watch this movie again a couple of times, and I have to tell you, I'm a little bit resentful over it. You know, I'm gonna wait till it's free, so it's probably gonna be, you know, a year before this thing is, you know, available to stream on Amazon Prime. But I have so many questions, Carolyn. Yeah. Like, I'm not gonna lie to you, okay? I'm not gonna lie to the audience. I wouldn't do that to y'all. It took me very many hours to realize what was going on with the red and the blue, not just on the armbands, but, you know, in other scenes, the way that, like, we are visually cued that someone is inverse or whether they're forward moving, that completely passed me by. I still do not know what happened during that car chase scene. You know, with the MacGuffin being thrown from the window from one car to the other, there's a part of my brain that either is cobwebbed over or is missing, because I don't think that I will ever be able to piece this together.
Yeah.
So I am coming to you, Carolyn.
Oh dear,
for
don't do that.
Tutoring, and I want you to break it down for me.
I still have a whole host of questions of my own, but I think one way we can look at this film as saying that what's happened has happened, and like there isn't really a way to change things is looking at that fight between the protagonist and himself, where, you know, when he comes into the room, on their first visit to the freehold or whatever it's called.
Freeport,
thank you. You know, the bullet holes in the window, in the glass, he's like, it hasn't happened yet. But then, you know, and then it does happen. But, I mean, like, when he is then on the other end of that fight, as the figure in the getup, in the mask and everything, like, he's still, like, he has the foreknowledge of what's happened because he's fighting himself, but he still like pulls the trigger. It's like he's fulfilling, you know, what already happened, when you'd think he could do something different, right? You'd think he could be like, well, there's no point in me doing that, so let me not do that. But no, but he does it anyway. So, I mean, I guess like my questions are things like, okay, so Sater, you know, Sater's loop ends when he is killed by Kat on the ship. However, like he exists in time after that because he had, you know, lived past that, and then that is the moment that he inverted himself and came back to be on the boat with her. So, but like, wouldn't the version of him in the future sort of know that the plan and the past had failed,
these are my questions,
and therefore like do different things like that, you know? That's where, and I'm sure that there are galaxy brain people who can explain to us why it all makes perfect sense. But, you know, like I think we are not alone in walking out of this film being like, wait a second, what?
And I feel like
this is a film that invites, though, it provokes those questions. I mean, in a lot of films, a lot of times, you know, somebody will say, what about this? And I'll be like, you're missing the point. Like, you're supposed to go along with it and, you know, suspension of disbelief and all that. But this is a film that relies entirely on these things. So it invites those kinds of questions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the same way that the film wants you to enjoy the sight of, like, John David Washington walking in that plum-colored suit, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It wants you to enjoy untangling these knots, you know?
Yes.
Such that when you do, you know, sort of understand something like, oh, I get it now. This is what was going on here. This is what this person was referring to. There's that, you know, that little thrill that you get, you know, from having unpacked something. This is not that, that, you know, kind of woeful exercise that people, and I admit I've done it myself in the past, where it's like, all right, but, you know, if you do this, doesn't it imply that this would have happened? So, like, the movie hole, you know, phenomenon, like, you know, the gross kind of like insistence upon, you know, uncovering every single instance where logic is ruptured as a way to dismiss a film wholesale. That's not what I'm interested in doing here.
Yeah,
it's not often that I say like, I didn't get it, but I'm happy to, you know, cop to being like I said, not unprepared, but just inept, you know, in this moment to really parse what's going on here. I really do feel as if like my work isn't done, you know, that I have to go back, you know, a couple of times.
But I mean, but, you know, should a film feel like a homework assignment?
That's the thing. You know, this is why I feel a little bit resentful. Like, I want to go back because I want to go back, not because it's impossible for me to understand, you know, what has happened. And that was built into the structure of the film. You know, can we talk about Robert Pattinson?
I was going to say, like, before we conclude, I do want to talk about him briefly. Yes.
Okay. I don't know how you felt about him, but I absolutely loved him in this movie because the way that he always is wearing, you know, this sort of secret smile as he moves through the film. And we learn, you know, at the end of the film, why that is, you know, but his sort of like quiet enjoyment of all of the ludicrous things happening around him and in which he is participating, I found absolutely delightful. And I read this GQ article with Robert Pattinson, and it was, I think, maybe midway through 2020 that the article appeared. So he had been, you know, under lockdown, like all of us, for a while. And the article was about, like, you know, how he is adapting or not adapting to being in isolation. And, you know, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk since he was cast as Batman about how, like, just wonderfully weird he is, wonderfully and authentically weird he is as a person. Like, his co-workers and, you know, his directors have talked about, like, no, what you see is what you get with Robert. And so I found this interview with him in GQ so refreshing because he talked about, like, how he didn't know what was going on.
So great.
In the film, but how he just embraced it and sort of, you know, walked through it. And I felt like I had the most fun with the film when I did the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, when I sort of, you know, like, let go of, like, that in kind of intenseness, that intensity and that earnestness and that, like, driving need to know that the protagonist has, but instead occupied a position like Neil and was just like, hey, this is what we're doing right now. You know, like, you'll understand in the sweet by and by. I really loved him in this.
Just enjoy the ride, right? He's got that, he has that wonderful, that playful quality to him. Like, there's a moment in the midst of the car chase where, like, he gets out of his car and, like, a bunch of, I guess, his satyr's men are, like, shooting at him from, you know, from behind another car. And he gets this, like, look on his face of, like, well, this is really too much. Like, this kind of just, it just plays across his face so quickly, this, like, kind of eye-rolling, like, exasperation, but not, like, not like terror or fear or whatever, but just like, oh, this, now I have to deal with this. And I mean, and he is a spark of life in this film. You know, when he's the one who kind of explains the stakes of the film to the audience, and, you know, to other characters, but also obviously to us, to the viewer. And, you know, he says, like, you know, somebody asks, what happens if the future does the thing with the MacGuffin or whatever, and he just says, oh, end of play. And it's just such a delicious way of putting it, but, like, and the way he says it on top of it is so delicious. So, so as we wrap up, I thought it would be fun for Ebony and I to do a throwback to a podcast we used to do called Cinema Ball, where we'd conclude our discussion of each film by rating it on Ebony's brother's patented 100-star scale. So I'll go first with my little wrap-up rating, and then Ebony can bring our Tenet talk to a close.
All right.
So, as I said, you know, I mean, again, aesthetically, I found this movie, you know, it's a film of many pleasures. I love, again, just seeing John David Washington in those outfits, in those places. You know, it has that global intrigue thing that I love. I like Robert Pattinson's playfulness, and I do like the aesthetic, the originality, the aesthetic originality that is allowed for by the core concept of the plot. However, like it ultimately, it did still leave me pretty cold. Overall, I didn't believe. I mean, I felt like its attempts to make us feel the human stakes through things like Kat's, relationship with Sator and the jockeying over her son and the fake Goya and all of that. They felt cursory to me. They didn't feel like they never rose beyond, again, just plot details, elements of like power play in the story that I understood at a remove, but I didn't really feel the stakes for the characters. And like Ebony alluded to, I did watch this film a second time, but it was purely out of like, okay, I want to see if I can understand this better. And it wasn't like, oh, I really feel like there's something going on here on a human level that's interesting and, that's saying something meaningful, like, or I want to like re-experience that. It was really purely about, can I diagram this film more clearly in my mind so that I just feel like I understand it better? And so, in that regard, the film is just, ultimately, it's missing something crucial. It's not really a success. As fascinating as I think it is, and as much as I will forever moving forward, have concepts in my head like temporal pincer movement or what have you that previously I didn't, and so I appreciate its impact in that regard. But so I am giving it 61 out of 100 stars.
Ooh, okay. I always have to put myself back into the brain space of my brother when I am about to deliver a 100 star rating. Mm-hmm. Because the way that my brother understands the usefulness of the 100 star system truly needs to be unpacked by him. He's devoted to it, and I'm glad that we've adopted it, in these special instances. I really appreciated, and know what I say, appreciated rather than enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I appreciated the architecture of this film. Mm. I was in awe of the complexity with which it was melded together, or welded together, I should say. But it felt throughout like an exercise. And an exercise that I'm not eager to repeat, but that I feel pressed to repeat to get the full experience. There are moments that are absolutely delightful. There are performances that stood out to me. There are things that we didn't even get to in the main body of our conversation, and so hopefully we'll get to talk about them in the bonus, like the editing. I could spend 20 minutes talking about the editing in this movie. but ultimately, it felt like something that I appreciated from afar, but have no interest in exploring, really in depth further. And that I find that a little bit disappointing, because I do think, like, John David Washington, holds so much promise. Like, he is such a charismatic actor. Neil Pattinson, absolutely bringing it. And I think there were some big ideas here that I could have really, really enjoyed wrapping my head around them. But ultimately, I didn't feel enough pull to do that. I am going to give it a 72.
Ooh, all right.
So a bit higher than Carolyn, but that's because I'm always grading on a curve. I don't want anybody to feel bad. John David Washington did look amazing in that plum suit. Robert Pattinson brought it with the floppy hair. Mm-hmm. There were moments I laughed out loud. But unfortunately, 72 is where I'm leaving it. Also, again, we didn't talk about this in the main, but some of the dialogue in this film is absolutely boneheaded, Like, there are just some real clunky lines. And you will, it's not just that John David Washington's character is called the protagonist. There are moments where I was like, this looks or sounds directly lifted from a first draft. Like, this could have been cleaned up.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, I'm giving it a 72.
There you have it. We will be right back to share our weekly freakouts. Hey, friends. Thanks for listening to FFR. If you enjoy our weekly conversations about the intersection of feminism and pop culture, consider hopping over to patreon.com/femfreak and joining our podcast community. You can get access to exclusive bonus episodes, join our friendly Discord server, participate in polls to help decide topics for future episodes, and more. Plus, you'll be helping us keep bringing FFR to the virtual podcast airwaves. Visit patreon.com/femfreak today. Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. Carolyn, what have you got for us? Well, Carolyn, I'm glad you asked. This week I just want to talk a bit about, this is going to be even by my standards, this is a niche, like an esoteric freak out. So this is like a niche within a niche. Say what?
I said, this is what I live for, when Carol goes full Caro.
Okay, so some of our listeners probably know what ASMR is. Some of you probably don't. So briefly, ASMR is a, you know, if you go on YouTube and you type in ASMR, you will get so many creators making what are called ASMR videos. They sometimes refer to themselves as ASMRtists. And ASMR videos are usually like soft-spoken videos. They sometimes involve a character or a figure, you know, on screen giving you, the viewer, like personal attention, or and often they can just be like a friend talking you down, like, hey, how are you doing? You anxious today? Oh, you know, calm down, it's gonna be okay, things like that. But at other times they can involve really intricate, elaborate plots. They can have high production values. Now, ASMR itself I don't remember what it stands for, but it refers to a pleasant, tingly feeling that in the brain that some of us experience in response to certain stimuli, like soft-spoken voices and, you know, personal attention and things like that. And I, particularly in this time of quarantine and isolation, I've been watching quite a bit of ASMR, not just, I do experience the brain tingles, but even beyond that, like, because in a way it is at times, I admit, a kind of substitute for like actual personal, like human interaction, or, you know, a bulwark against like profound loneliness. But so the reason I'm bringing this up is there is a particular ASMR creator who does work that's off the beaten path, right? It is more unusual. It is more challenging. It is more intellectual, philosophical than a lot of other ASMR creators. His channel name is Phoenician Sailor. Phoenician, like Phoenician. Phoenician Sailor. And the reason I bring him up today is he has a Tenet ASMR video, a Tenet-themed ASMR video. And so it's not unusual for ASMR creators in general, or him in particular, to do ASMR that's inspired by certain properties. Like, he has a Westworld ASMR video. He has a Far Cry 5, I think, ASMR video, and other, like, a Last of Us ASMR video. And so it's really, in a sense, a lot of these in particular, he also has a lot of original work, but these in particular, you could think of them as ASMR fan fiction, right? And so,
interesting.
And so his Tenet video, like, is emblematic of the work that he does in terms of, like, the production values are truly, like, outstanding. You know, the way the video works is he is talking to you, the viewer, right? You, the viewer, are a character in this scenario, this Tenet themed scenario, and, you know, and I don't want to sort of necessarily give away the details of the plot of the thing, but I understand that the level of viewers that he gets are reflective of the fact that he is doing work that's off the beaten path, right? He's sort of like the prog rock, you know, artist who knows that they're never going to hit the big time because they're just doing work that's like too challenging for the masses, man, or whatever. But I really think he deserves more viewership more, you know, on his work, because it's really exceptional. So if you go to YouTube and you just Google, or not Google, but you type in the YouTube search bar Tenet ASMR, he should be the first, you know, or certainly one of the first results. And yeah, I think, you know, it's there's just so much to appreciate in his dedication to, again, to production values that really make you feel immersed in in the world that he is in which the story is set. In this case, the kind of world of Tenet. So that's my shout out to, you know, one of the many ASMR creators who's been doing work that I have found valuable in these difficult times, and who I think deserves special attention, and who it's thematically appropriate for me to celebrate on this episode because of the Tenet connection. So, you know,
I love that I'm more inclined to go search out some Tenet ASMR than I am to watch the movie again. Mm-hmm. But when you were describing, I was like, I kind of want to check this out. It was when you called it Tenet fan fiction, and I was like, oh, I'm in.
It is totally Tenet fan fiction, and it's, you know, and it is philosophical. It does get, you know, into stuff that's, you know, the thing, a lot of ASMR videos purely stick to kind of comforting subject matter because, you know, a lot of times you're watching these videos to be comforted. You know, because he ventures into larger questions of, you know, mortality and humanity and things like that, I will say that Phoenician Sailor's videos aren't always the most comforting ASMR videos, but they are... But they are always among the most, like, original and stimulating, and you know, he really is, I think, doing some really cool things with the form of the ASMR video. So, So that's it for our freakouts this week. Remember that you can submit your own freakout at feministfrequency.com/freakout. Thanks so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Join us next week for a conversation about Promising Young Woman, the provocative new film starring Carey Mulligan, which is now available for viewing on demand. Demand it! Go say, Jeff Bezos, I demand that you let me watch Promising Young Woman. Or actually watch it somewhere other than Amazon. You don't have to give Jeff Bezos your money all the time. Anyway... Our show is engineered by Rob Pera. Carrie Stimson provides technical support. Artwork is by Jamie Varon, and our intro music is by Phil Circus. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.
Tenet.
Tenet. Tenet.
Rewind.